Hello, and welcome to Korean Context. My name is Nicholas Hamasevich, Director of Research and Academic Affairs at KEI, and I will be your host today. In this episode, we talk with Dr. Adam Cathcart about China-North Korea relations. Dr. Cathcart has just written an academic paper series report for KEI examining China-North Korea cooperation in special economic zones along the border and the future of the Chinese-North Korean relationship after the purge of Jong Sung-taek. He also recently visited the border region between China and North Korea. Dr. Adam Cathcart, thank you so much for joining us here on Korean Context.
Glad to be here.
You wrote an academic paper series report for us, and you mentioned that North Korea made some agreements with China on the Hwanggampyeong and Weihua Island SEZs. Your paper goes on to describe how, under Kim Jong-un, North Korea seems to be moving away from these two projects, and you give some examples, including the purge of Jong Sung-taek, who was chairman or part of these projects, to illustrate this possible change in emphasis from North Korea. Do you think North Korea is moving away from these SEC projects because it was done under Kim Jong-il, and now Kim Jong-un is trying to separate himself? Or is it something else, like it really was Jong Sung-taek and that kind of dynamic? Or North Korea really just wants to build SEZs elsewhere and not really in these two areas?
With respect to the Kim Jong-il part of the question, is Kim Jong-un trying to set up a system that moves away from what his father had done? I think that would be very unlike everything else that we've seen about Kim Jong-un, where at least the father is nominally praised to the skies. Even during Jang's purge, the moment at which he was kicked out of the party, there were not two portraits behind Kim Jong-un, but one, and it was his father. And the purge document kind of talked about this is sort of revenge for Kim Jong-il. You know, we're really getting you, Uncle Jang, because you wronged my father, right? You wronged Kim Jong-il. So I think that that's very much part of North Korea's political culture, where at least Kim Jong-un needs to be seen to be following his father's projects. The only way that we might see that as being the case is if Jong-il were really not in his own mind, you know, while making these agreements with China in 2010 and 2011 in particular, but back to 2009 even, when the Chinese leadership came to Pyongyang and had conversations and where this was all explicitly agreed upon. And I don't think that North Korea is willing to admit that, and I don't think that Kim Jong-il was, out of his own mind. He seemed to be pretty with it up, you know, close to his death, even to the point where his son was not really meeting at the same level with Chinese leaders as he was. So I think Kim Jong-il was very rational in some ways about accepting these Chinese projects, and I think that those are the kind of projects that could be reversed by the North Koreans at any time, irrespective of which Kim is in charge. But as to the question of do they just want to redo it on their own terms, I think that's very much what we're seeing. And I think that that does reflect some discord within the North Korean leadership about how do we manage this relationship with China? Do we want to have really wholesale economic ties with them, or do we see maybe too many Chinese imports coming in, too much Chinese yuan washing around in the markets, and, you know, just elites in Pyongyang hoarding Chinese yuan? You know, this is a bad thing in some ways from the regime's perspective. And I think the special economic zones are part of a larger question of how North Korea manages China and tries to keep them in some ways at arm's length, yet available if they do want to move forward with some projects. And they have, you know, to their credit, but certainly we have to acknowledge that these new economic development zones they've set up, several of them are right on the frontier with China. So while they're slamming the door on Hwanggampyeong Island and Weihua Island, or seem to be doing so, they're also kind of leaving the window ajar, I suppose, with these economic development zones right on the border.
In your presentation, you were talking about how the difference between Kim Il-sung kind of emphasizing the northeast part of North Korea and Rasong, and then Kim Jong-il doing northwest, North Pyongyang province, Sinwiju. I guess that's kind of what I was thinking about when asking you about Kim Jong-un was moving away from his father and moving toward Kim Il-sung type of dynamic, because you point out very well the legacy politics and legacy issues in which Kim are you following. You still don't see that in this scenario, in the SEZs in Sinwiju, that's the case. K Kim Jong-un is moving away from Kim Jong-il.
Well, I think it's the case where if he is taking a strategy that's more akin to that of his grandfather, where the Northwest becomes kind of a site for security, you've got to prevent leaks, you've got to store up arms, you've got to create it as a site for food production as opposed to sort of manufacturing production. I don't know that it is implicitly a rejection of his father, if that makes sense. Not to split too fine hairs there, but
right.
I think when it comes to Rasan, they're more willing to do it for, in some ways, some very traditional reasons, which is, of course, it's far away from Pyongyang. You can manage it. I spoke to some people who go to North Korea very frequently based in Yenji, some folks affiliated with the Pyongyang Project and others, and they talked about going into Rasan with North Korean colleagues and North Korean tour guides begging them to go to Rasan so that they could finally get in. And these are North Koreans who speak English, speak Chinese. You know, they're involved in the tourism trade, and they haven't been to Rasan in a decade. So the barriers for even normal North Koreans to get it in and out of there are still very substantial. Whereas Sinuiju, it's a city that people go through all the time to get to China, especially the dynamic zones are slightly removed from the city itself. But you're talking about it's just much closer to a major urban area and one that the North Koreans have always been a bit nervous about. It's been kind of an aberrant city in some ways. And the province, I mean, North Pyongan is not always the easiest place to govern.
So whether it's the op-ed in the Financial Times by Dong Yuwen, Chinese companies publicly complaining about doing business in North Korea, or some of the Chinese writings and articles you mentioned in your paper, it seems that some of the media and some commentators want to take these as signs that China's finally moving away from North Korea and from its support toward North Korea. In your opinion, how should people assess these changes and dynamics in China-North Korea relations?
Well, I think we absolutely have to pay very close attention to the Chinese discourse on North Korea. It would be a big mistake to think that it's all smoke and mirror, or as Mao told Kissinger, that it was all just empty cannon fire. You know, these are not empty statements that they're making. And I think that if Deng Yuan or other kind of prominent Chinese academics are writing in prominent Western or Chinese outlets saying negative things about North Korea, we absolutely have to take that into account. What I think we have to caution against is reading any single statement as kind of a harbinger of a major policy shift. We have to read as much as possible and also get the sense of, are they just venting? Because that's also possible, you know, that simply, well, this is a painful relationship. The North Koreans aren't making it easy for us. We should really think about maybe cutting loose. But does that have any purchase in the Central Committee or the Standing Committee? Is there going to be any actual shift? I think that's the tricky part. So looking at what Chinese scholars are saying as being a very important part of where the discourse is going, and they're at least opening up policy options. What are historians saying about who started the Korean War? This stuff matters. What did the Chinese call the Korean War? Are they thinking about maybe it was a mistake to get in the first place? I see it as laying the groundwork for a longer term shift, not as evidence of a current shift that is in the process of occurring, right? Or it has occurred or is about to occur. It's nothing, it's glacial, right? It's glacial and cumulative, as opposed to Mao used to make decisions fast and then impose them on everyone in the whole society, got behind it. That's not going to happen. This is more of kind of a consensus model in some ways of policy formation toward North Korea. But the signs are not good for North Korea. I would just add very quickly about Deng Yuan. I was told that now he did lose his job after publishing that editorial, but some people have said he was already on the way out and was sort of looking for a postdoc in the United States anyway. So he's landed very nicely, apparently. They continue to publish about North Korea. It's not as if there's been some gag rule imposed. In some ways, the media market in China is freer than it's ever been in terms of a range of material available about North Korea that people can grasp and learn a lot of things about. The gulags are still somewhat under the radar, but people are even talking about those in China.
So what are some of the main Chinese sources that people should be looking at for these discussions about North Korea or these events about North Korea?
Yeah, well, because China is such a global player, and the phrase we love in Washington is stakeholder, right? They're such a major stakeholder in the relationship with North Korea. There's so many scholars out and about. I mean, you can watch them. I always learn a lot, and I'm always behind. There's a lot of people out talking, whether it's Zhu Feng or others, presenting not the Chinese line, but simply kind of Chinese thinking and various kind of grades of that on the North Korea issue. The Global Times, I think, is an important outlet, although the English language version is somewhat different and quite different in the Chinese version. So SinoNK, the website I run, we do try to provide some translations of those important editorials and stories. But the foreign affairs periodicals, the Shijie Zhishi or World Affairs, is an important text. And then just People's Daily, China Daily, some good reporting occasionally from the border region. They'll go to Dandong and talk to people. And in the last few months even, we saw changes. When I was in Manchuria in April, I found them interviewing North Korean business people who did not want to be named in Dandong. And I thought, that is incredible. You know, it's pretty rare to see Chinese reporters acting like Western reporters. But that's starting to happen. So the information marketplace is pretty robust. And then, of course, trying to get some of the granular information like, you know, Weibo tweets or, you know, the social media feeds of various public security organizations along the border. I know that oftentimes when we talk about North Korea, the phrase intelligence black hole is used. And I don't think that that's entirely true when it comes to Chinese language material, because occasionally when China wants to reveal something, there will be a long article about Chinese capitalists complaining about how they couldn't get their money back at this time, or what's going on in Dandong. Is there a Chinese company investing in North Korea or not? What's the Chinese army doing on the border region? How many refugees are coming across? We don't know that. But we do know even things like, is the North Korean consulate in Shenyang going up to Yenji to have a look around, and how much coordination occurs between Chinese and North Korean security forces and border police. There are a lot of ways to find that stuff out ethically, you know. So I think that that is something that I'm certainly committed to, and I think there's a lot more information there that needs to be more open source as well. I mean, I think that things like Twitter and blogging have made it quite easy to share, but it still takes a lot of time to take something from Chinese, put it into English, or to cross-reference even Nodong Shinmun articles that are produced in English, Chinese, and Korean, and to try to parse out the differences in each one of those variations. And sometimes those are really important. Different audiences, the document's a bit different. I mean, the Jiangsu Tech Purge, we translated some of that from Chinese into English, and it was somewhat different. You know, they're talking to different audiences. Very interesting.
There was a good article in the spring 2014 edition of the Global Asia magazine. So the author, Yun Chul Kim from Inje University, saying that Hwanggeumpyeong Island and that complex will influence North Korea's policy on economic cooperation with South Korea, including Kaesong. He doesn't really give a lot of detail after that statement, but do you think this is true? You know, what are the connections for North Korea with its economic relations with China in these SEZs along the border? They're still thinking about South Korea with these SEZs.
Well, that's a very important question, because part of what it implies is that the SEZs on the Chinese-North Korean frontier could be used as a vehicle for inter-Korean trade, right? You could have South Korean companies setting up factories, funding factories, et cetera, on this Chinese leased land, right? North Korean land that's been leased to China, but these are international zones. They wouldn't operate, obviously, there'd be no, in terms of the currency, you'd probably be dealing in dollars, euros, Chinese yuan, et cetera. But that's certainly a possibility. And I think that the North Koreans are, in some ways, wary of engagement on the northern frontier, and they're concerned about Chinese-South Korean business connections. For example, in a way that they want to take the opportunity when they choose. They don't want to be presented with kind of a united Chinese South Korean front, right? And obviously, in terms of business, it's explicit self interest, isn't it? So, I think that when it comes to Kaesong, and I haven't been to Kaesong, I don't know sort of all the ins and outs of how the zone works and the laws. But I think that China's watching it very carefully, because they want to see that North Korea can kind of play by the rules, and that they're not going to blow the whole project up, because it bodes poorly for the investment in the north as well. And I think that in terms of the northern zones, when you look to the south and when you look to Kaesong, I mean, there's already so much trade from the northeast of China into Incheon, right? And that trade route is very, very well established. And if you're able to move goods from, you know, from Xinhuizhou, from China directly through Shenzhen to Pyongyang and on to South Korea, then you're talking about, okay, now we're talking about some legitimate sort of loops, as opposed to sort of there's so many partial loops.
Right.
When it comes to the way trade is set up and human flows, right, and information flows and all the rest. But if you're getting some real sort of inter-Korean feedback loops through Sun Wiju through Northeast China and into North Korea. You're talking about some potentially very productive stuff. But I do, just to get to the core of the question, I think that China's watching Kaesong very closely and has a real strong interest in making sure that succeeds. And I think that they expressed that pretty explicitly to their North Korean counterparts at the appropriate times.
That's kind of my next follow-up question, because the Yeonchul Kim kind of goes on to say that North Korea needs to have decent inter-Korean relations and Kaesong in order to attract Chinese foreign capital. And do you think this is the case, that they are thinking, well, we do need to kind of keep Kaesong open and kind of look like we're dealing with the South Koreans so that these Chinese will still work with us and deal with us, whether it's in the SEZs or elsewhere in North Korea?
My perception is that that point might be slightly overstated, because I think that from the North Korean standpoint, they obviously don't want Kaesong to become a huge problem, and they don't want the world and the Chinese in particular to be criticizing them for basically having mismanaged and broken various agreements there. But when it comes to Chinese investment, it's the proximity of power, it's the inevitability of geography, it's the victory of geography in a way, because China's always going to be there. The Chinese market is growing on the other side of the border. The Chinese are always going to be interested in setting up zones, presumably, and are going to be willing to invest. But because of the way China has set up the system, they want companies to lead. So a company is going to make a rational decision to invest in North Korea based on the overall environment for investment. And North Korea can create all the laws it wants, but if it's not following the laws that are already on the books and not abiding by agreements that are already in place, obviously it's going to deter investors. So I would just put a point on the professor's point and basically say that if it's Chinese companies, then they are, of course, looking at Kaesong to say, you know, are the North Koreans going to just, you know, nationalize our assets and kick us out at a moment's notice? But Kaesong is not the only data point. I mean, they've also got China's own experiences with the Xi'an group having been expropriated and kicked out of the country, and kind of a long track record of very unique sort of North Korean-Chinese burns, if you will. So Kaesong's important, but it's not the only game in town when it comes to kind of Chinese companies making decisions about making investments along the frontier.
A lot of the aspects when looking at China-North Korean relations are the different kind of groups or organizations that kind of connect with North Korea, whether it's the International Liaison Department or whether it's someone in the Chinese Communist Party or whether it's the vice president of China going to North Korea. So for people looking at these movements, how do you assess them, and what organizations or groups should we be looking at when they visit North Korea or North Koreans go to China?
China has a very abnormal relationship with North Korea. It's not a normal state-to-state. They've got a party-to-party relations. And that has been a very unique point where China set up this international liaison department that in many ways its main job is to deal with North Korea, to set up ties. One of the things that, aside from, you know, most people who aren't specialists don't really care. You know, it's sort of, you know, the North Koreans and the Chinese keep going along with their ideological way, or China's getting rich and they want to get rid of North Korea, whatever the interpretation is. That data point doesn't really come into consideration. You know, is it party to party or state to state? But if you're Chinese and you're a member of the Communist Party and you want to make the North Koreans think a little bit deeper about how they may or may not be playing by the rules and making the right steps to keep their relationship with China harmonious, if you change that fact and you basically make it country to country and you make a more normal relationship, more in the way that China would deal with any other country, use the foreign ministry, right? So if you elevate the foreign ministry, if you downplay the ILD, then you force the North Koreans to recognize, wow, this is okay. They're treating us a little more like everybody else. Maybe that's not a good thing from the North Korean standpoint. And that seems to be what's happening now in the Chinese-North Korean relationship. And I think that is fairly important. Just like when China changes what it calls the Korean War, you know, it's not the war to resist America and aid Korea. Now it's just the Korean War. They're starting to do that when they complain about, you know, North Korea not taking care of the graves of Chinese people's volunteers. When they try basically to turn North Korea into a normal country and to say, yes, your party is important, but we're interested in the state. And they always, in the declarations, they talk about the people and the government and the party as kind of connecting. You know, they're always kind of specifically laid out this kind of connection. It's Dang, Zhengfu, the party and the government. Right? And the party often comes first. And if you downplay that and you basically say, we don't really care about fraternal ties with your party, we want you to operate on our principles of national interest. And if you mess things up, we're gonna let you have it, at least rhetorically, or we're not going to give you all the things you want. So that channel for communication, if the ILD is in fact being sort of not mothballed but downplayed, and the foreign ministry is kind of coming to the fore, you know, Sino-Japanese relations also comes into play here. If North Korea is being nice to Japan, a little too nice, China's not going to like that. So they've got many, many pressure points and many ways to express displeasure with what North Korea is doing. And one of the ways they can do it is to move towards this more sort of normal state of affairs. But there are so many points of connection, right? There's military to military. There's cultural group to cultural group. One of the things that was totally unremarked upon this last April, right, when we thought Chinese-North Korean relations were kind of not in a freezing point, but the Chinese were using all kinds of phrases like, it's an obstacle, or we have to climb over some hills, or, you know, there's a stumbling block in the way after the Jang death. You know, we're not that happy about where things are. They nevertheless sent a very important state ballet ensemble to North Korea for the April Friendship Festival, and they gave performances for a whole week. And of course, a lot of North Koreans went to the performances, and the Chinese tried to show out of their way. They had a conference beforehand, they had a conference afterwards, and they let the North Koreans know. They invited the North Korean ambassador to a private performance in Beijing of this group. And when things like that happen, it matters because it gives these groups a chance to kind of rub shoulders. Then the Chinese can kind of get a sense of who's there, who isn't there. Are these people who have worked with us in the past going to be there? Yes, primarily they are. So it's just because you've moved from a party to a state relationship doesn't mean that all this sort of comradely stuff, you know, state ensembles dealing with each other. And I've been to rehearsals, actually, of this Chinese ensemble. And one of the leaders came and gave a talk and sort of mentioned, you know, you guys are better than the North Korean group. I've been there. And, you know, it's kind of, these are counterparts, parallel institutions. And they're kind of mutually comprehensible to each other. So even if you change what it's called, and North Korea is taking a message from that, they're still trying to do enough of this kind of normal sort of fraternal communist interactions, the trade fairs in Dandong being another example. They're trying to keep it going. So we shouldn't think that this whole thing, because of one editorial Deng Yuan wrote, you know, has been torpedoed. We have to be a little more cautious, I think, in our assessment.
What do good China-North Korea relations look like if they're getting on a path back toward better relations? What do you think that would look like? Some signposts when we look at China-North Korea relations saying, oh, they might, looks like they're getting back on track and having better relations than what they have now or, you know, the past couple months.
Well, in some ways, I wish I could give an answer that says lots of special economic zones along the frontier, more freedom of movement for North Koreans in and out of China, more overseas Chinese in North Korea, which is an important population, being able to move back and forth, more open communications along the border, Chinese being able to use their cell phones, that sort
That's
of thing.
One.
You know, food going across the border and North Koreans not having stunted growth as a result of a lack of calories. I mean, there's so much surplus in the Chinese Northeast that could be put to good use. And I think that small-scale trade, tourism, things like that. But that's my fantasy, right? And that's, in some ways, the idea that the Chinese Communist Party leaders have as well in the border region. That's what they'd like to see. But it's not normal. And so to kind of lower our level of expectation, because we know what South Korea is like, we know what it's like in Manchuria, it would be very obvious and easy for us to lay out a path where North Korea could participate more in the regional system. Short of unification, right? I mean, absolutely. I mean, they have every opportunity to kind of connect with what's out there, whether it's Chinese high-speed trains, opening restaurants, and I'd love to see more North Korean tourists in China, but it very rarely happens for obvious reasons because of income differentials. So what does normal look like means has to come back to very much these core issues. And one of the core issues and the core structural abnormalities is the North Korean nuclear program. Mm-hmm. And that's where China and South Korea, I think, are pretty much on the same page with the United States, more or less, about North Korean denuclearization. And I think that's a huge stumbling block now because they've really doubled down on created this Byungjin line, right? The parallel development of the economy and the nuclear program. Allegedly, they're connected in the North Korean eye. And they're not back at the six-party talks. China wants them back and needs them back. So I think kind of a realistic way of saying normal would be North Korea back at the negotiating table at the very least, having come back to some of these, I think it's the September 19th agreement, about goal of the six-party talks is denuclearization. And they have gone so far away from that now, where they're basically saying, accept us as a nuclear power. The new line, which we'll be hearing this year, is if we do nuclear tests or missile tests, this is routine and, you know, annual, very much the same way that U.S. ROK security happens. So why are you upset? And push on the Byungjin line. I mean, that they really demand the nuclear deterrent. And I think that what China would like to see is for them to back away from that. And then, you know, more aid comes in, the sanctions get a little less heavy, etc. I wish I had a better answer. Yeah. I mean, it's not a very positive outlook now. And I think that, you know, if China can play the same game we can, which is kind of, we're going to make life difficult for you. If China's making them pay global rates for oil, which I think they already are, but if they don't allow as many remittances back in, if China, actually this is a paradox, if China starts controlling the border a little better, it's not just about sanctions enforcement, it's about our remittances coming back in. If China cracks down enough, you know, it can make life painful for Pyongyang. And then, you know, the luxury goods, who defines luxury goods? If the customs officials along the border get a little more strict about that sort of stuff, they can cause pain. And I think that's where China wants to keep a little leverage in reserve, because they can't do everything we want them to do. But I think that there's more pressure they can put on North Korea, but they don't really want to, right? And I think that's a really big question. You know, what does normal look like?
For the Chinese, at least from your understanding and what you've read, is a nuclear test the worst thing that North Korea could do? And then missiles a little less so? Or is there a connection between, okay, North Korea is testing ballistic missiles, and there is a possibility that they could eventually put a nuclear weapon on one of these things. Is there a connection between missile tests and nuclear tests for the Chinese?
One thing I saw in December 2012, it must have been, this was shortly before one of the missile tests that was done, I think it was early December, maybe 2012. Jiangsun Tech was in the control room, in fact, they, you know, put the quote-unquote satellite in orbit. I saw a graphic of North Korean missile ranges, and that was in the Chinese media. And one of the things that it did is, we're so used to looking at those going east, right, towards the United States. It's right. A matter of perspective. And they flipped it, and they made the missile range going west, which is pretty normal from a Chinese perspective. But it was shocking to see how much of China was now covered in this, you know, the bathed in the red of danger from North Korea. I think they know that things could go south pretty quickly, things could go badly. It's where China's ancient history helps them be cautious. Back to the history of the Koguryo, even. I mean, they know what it's like to be fighting not just a sort of vaguely hostile, but a totally hostile and completely mobilized northern Korean state. I've heard Chinese analysts, in fact, at the Asan conference last year, make a comment about North Korean nuclear proliferation, and it's got to stop because they might give nuclear weapons to Uyghur terrorists in Xinjiang. I mean, these are kind of things that, to me, you know, these are small signs, but they indicate certainly a kind of a Chinese nervousness about North Korean proliferation. I think the missile program is a very serious problem. They had even artillery, long-range artillery. There was a test not so long ago, and it went over the flight path of a Shenyang to Tokyo airliner, which ironically is the route being used by these negotiators, the Japanese negotiators, to come talk to the North Koreans about things like comfort women and, you know, Japanese remains from World War II, you know, 1945 and 46 in Chongjin, things like that. So, you know, the Chinese, basically, a Chinese general published an op-ed that said, you know, we felt really threatened by this, and you can't do this kind of thing, because even during military drills, we don't shoot this close. We don't shoot missiles or long-range artillery through flight paths. It's extremely provocative and extremely dangerous. So I think it's part of this larger question for the Chinese about, our civilians do not feel safe, right? Our citizens need to be protected, and there's quite a discourse in China about that, isn't there? Kind of strong state, the party and the army are going to protect you. And that's part of the basic sort of domain consensus or, you know, political agreement that the people have with the government, right? As long as that they seem to have hammered out since 1990 in China. So if North Korea is threatening Chinese security in the border region, if these nuclear tests are happening and causing earthquakes, that's going to be a major point of leverage for China to cooperate more with the United States, to go to the UN and say, yeah, absolutely, we agree with these sanctions. Tighten up, and we'll tighten up on the border as well. And they've been trying to do their best to express, you know, how they're working on this issue. I mentioned in the talk today about a major document about tech sanctions, right? There's certain technological types of things that they're not allowing into North Korea. They were very explicit about, we have North Koreans learning high tech in China, you know, they're studying abroad, but they're not learning stuff that they can put to use for these missile programs or for nuclear technology and things like that. So I'm not bullish on what China is doing. I don't think that the enforcement is perfect. And I, you know, there's people in the PLA who probably have a very different view of everything than myself, and certainly even probably people in the Central Committee. But I think by and large, China is trying to slow the rate of this development and trying to create both, what is it, carrots and sticks. Chinese strategy has a tendency to be a little heavier on the carrots simply because they're closer. It fits in with what China's trying to do in the Northeast, economic development generally, living standards.
You recently visited some cities in the areas along the Chinese-North Korean border. What were some of your takeaways from that recent trip?
Well, I spent a morning on April 15th in Jilin City, which is about 6 hours by bus from the North Korean border. It's quite far. And there's a large group meeting of North Koreans there to kind of celebrate the birth of the leader. It's at the school that Kim Il-sung attended as a middle school student. And I had the sense that the business presence of North Koreans in the region is fairly robust there. These restaurants seem to be doing fairly well. I'm not so sure about the garment workers and things like that. That's still very much probably in the future. So there's room for growth, obviously. Talking to Chinese in the border region gives you a much more pessimistic point of view. If you go to a place like Yanji, which isn't that far from Rasson, you've got development like gangbusters. I mean, they're building kind of a whole new Yanji city to the west of downtown, new government complex, brand new museum, new city library, provincial library. They call it the Autonomous Region Library. Real estate prices going up. It's great. There's a high-speed rail coming in. It's very, you know, you're going to be able to be in Shenyang in 3.5 hours or something from Yanji. It's quite a long ways. Yanji's connected to Harbin, and it's quite exciting. So there's this growth there, and there's a kind of a dynamism. And then you go and look at North Korea, and it's very similar to the way it's always been. You know, the hillsides are denuded. You're seeing people doing hand farming. You're there for 3 hours, and you see one tractor. Basically, people going home at, I don't know, I guess it's a little before 7 p.m. You know, do they even have electricity to watch television, you know, the nightly news and things like that. And then you see little signs like, oh, there'll be a tourism development. So I was glad to get some of this information before it came out on Yonhap, because I'm there and you can see the banners that are up, and there's sort of, you know, sign up for this, you know, bus tour or train tour to, we might go to Chongjin or those kind of things. So there's a small amount of tourism that's kind of opening up again, reopen things that have been closed for a while. There's a Chinese bike tour from Tumen to Namyang City. But that's really, really small. That's small ball. That's really small stuff. Compared to the kind of dynamism that you see on the Chinese side, new factories going up, Huncheon's grown a lot. Dandong obviously has grown massively. I think it's quite intimidating from a North Korean point of view. I don't know how I would be feeling or what I would be doing right now if I were the chair of the, you know, North Pyongan Province Korean Workers' Party. Because you're really in between a rock and a hard place. If you express a desire to work with Chinese partners in Pyongyang, that's probably not seen very clear, not very kindly, right? So you want to keep relations with your colleagues across the river, but it needs to be done through Pyongyang. Pyongyang wants the provinces to send money back to the center, right, to develop Pyongyang. But all the money's in China, and there are political problems with that, you know, that border connection and kind of getting money from businesses in Dandong. And finally, there's the bridge, which has now basically been completed from North Korea to China. It's a new bridge. Yes, it's an update on a 1919 original. It's a brand new bridge. So I don't know that it's a game changer, but it's potentially a major increase in infrastructure and in transportation connections between China and the Korean Peninsula. It's literally blocked at the North Korean end. It goes to nowhere. There's a wall around it. And so possibility for transformation, it's there. China's built the infrastructure, they've paid for it. But now North Korea seems to be moving the goalposts and totally pulling the plug on the special economic zones that they'd set up with Jiangsung Tech and starting a whole new line of thinking with a Hong Kong company, and it's all on paper. Whereas when it comes to what's happening on the Chinese side of the border, you can see it, you can smell it, you can stand in a pile of rubble, you know, because they're going to build something. Literally, it's a bit cliched, but I remember going out to the Yenji Museum one of the days that I was there. And on my way there, I thought, oh, very interesting. Here's a gate about some kind of environmental company, you know, the greenhouse or something like that. And on my way back, they'd smashed it. The whole thing was gone. They just bulldozed it for real estate or government offices or whatever.
Wow.
You know, in the space of literally one afternoon. And so when China wants to do something, it happens pretty quick. And in North Korea, it seems that the decision-making process for how to deal with China economically is still very contested. And they're going to muddle along until they can figure it out, until they feel strong enough about kind of the direction that they want to move and their whole attitude toward the northern frontier, because it can change things very quickly. This is potentially very, very transformative for the region, if not North Korea generally, right? And it's a source that they've got, but they don't know how to manage it. They don't know how to deal with it. And I think until that fear can be transformed into kind of pragmatism or some kind of adaptability, it's going to be a lot of talk. We've got young leadership in Pyongyang, but really it's a young face on a very, very old system. And there's still a lot of very old timers in there. I spoke to a North Korean diplomat actually about this recently, and I asked him about what's the quality within the North Korean diplomatic corps now, people who are coming up. And he said, these young diplomats, they're sort of a different breed, you know, like young people anywhere. They're aggressive. They've got new ideas. You know, they're ready to go. Now, of course, he's not going to tell me they're ready to have massive Chinese investment and just have holiday in, Mount Pekto on the Chinese side, or go to Beijing, you know, for holiday. I'm not sure that that's what he means anyway. But the fact is that I think there is people at places like PUST, the Pyongyang University of Science and Technology. More people are learning Chinese now. There is a Confucius Institute in Pyongyang. You know, they've got about 700 graduates a year. Stuff is happening. I think we know it could happen, move a lot faster. But the fact that it's moving at all, I think, is at least, you know, one small positive takeaway. That the groundwork is being laid for a different kind of Korea, different Korean-Chinese relationship. I think that's a good thing.
Dr. Cathcart, thank you so much. Fascinating topics, as always, and we appreciate your insight on all these issues. Thank you.
Sure. Anytime.
Our guest today was Dr. Adam Cathcart, lecturer in Chinese history at the University of Leeds, and founder and editor-in-chief of the website SinoNK. Thank you so much for listening to KAI's Korean Context podcast, and we hope you will listen again next time.